There it is.
I always take my lead from the crowd. You all quieted down. That was a good signal that we are starting. And so I'm going to call the meeting of the Ocean Protection Council to order. And I was going to do a few opening comments about certain things. And the very first one is I get to welcome Jordan Diamond, the new public member who I swore in this morning, so she is officially now a member of the Ocean Protection Council. Congratulations. And she is the executive director of the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at the UC Berkeley School of Law, co-directs the Law of the Sea Institute at Berkeley Law, and her work has really focused on environmental laws and policies, that they're based on the best information available, developed through inclusive and transparent processes, and implemented through adaptive and accountable systems. So that's a perfect fit for the Ocean Protection Council. And she told me that she doesn't like people talking endlessly. She didn't really tell me that. I am just adding that for effect. So she's just a total fit to the council. She was the co-director of the Ocean Program at the Environmental Law Institute and worked in a bunch of different programs related to that. And so I think we're just thrilled to have her here. And a lot of us have talked to her or will talk to her just to get to know her and have her get to know the Ocean Protection Council and the role. And she told me how excited she is. And in a moment when I recognize any council member that has comments, I have a feeling she'll want to say something to start her service with the council. So welcome. And I also want to welcome Liz Whiteman, the new executive director of the Ocean Science Trust. It seems a little hollow to say I'm welcoming her. At one point, she was acting. She's been in front of us many times. She's just new to this role on a permanent basis, and we're very grateful for it. I know that she's been at the Ocean Science Trust since 2008. And really was there at the height of the design and implementation of the marine protected areas, and subsequently has served as a member of the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel, a name that I read because I have to include hypoxia, and most recently led a panel of experts to synthesize the state of sea level rise in California, which was really useful to us in having a timely report on that and the guidance. And she's trained as a marine ecologist in the UK. She did her own personal Brexit and spent a decade in the Caribbean promoting science-informed decisions for fisheries and protected area management. And the Caribbean was not hot enough for her, so she's here in Sacramento today. And then finally, I want to welcome Jay Stakowitz, who's sitting next to Liz, who's one of the co-chairs of the OPC's science advisory team. He's a professor and chair in the Department of Evolution and Ecology at UC Davis. He's an ecologist interested in the causes and consequences of biodiversity and how biodiversity variation affects entire ecosystems. He's been on the science advisory team since 2008. I chatted with him before, and he talked about doing some of his field work at the Institute in Bodega Bay, but is located in Davis. And he was co-chair of the recent SAT working group investigating the potential for submerged aquatic vegetation to ameliorate the effects of ocean acidification. And I know that both Jay and Liz will give an update on item 3 of our agenda. We have an action-packed agenda today. We have a lot to do in a not extensive amount of time. So we're going to take public comment after items 4, 5, 6, and 7. Allow for comment on non-agenda items. At the back of the room, you can find speaker cards. Please fill one out for each agenda item on which you wish to speak. Please write legibly, because I will be introducing you by how you write. And if you don't write it clearly, understand that your name will be slaughtered. And then put the cards in the basket at the front of the room. Public comments are limited to 3 minutes each. And I should say also, because we have such an action agenda and we're trying to get through it, I think on one item we have 8 different grants we're going to make in relation to applicants, and there is no need to speak. It is almost to be present in case there are questions, because we will be here the rest of our natural life if people speak, and we have detailed explanations of each proposal and their recommendation that in our packet that we have looked at. If you just have to do it. But it's when I was mayor of Santa Cruz, I used to say, you're starting with 7 votes and you can only go down. And so be careful what you say when you do that. So I will just ask if there are any other comments by members of the council. Michael.
Thank you, Chair Laird. I just want to briefly mention the Hollister Ranch Settlement Agreement issue. Coastal Access, as many of you know, is enshrined in the California Constitution and Coastal Act. I'm a member of the Gaviota Coast Conservancy, and we are one of the parties that are petitioning to intervene in the settlement and hoping that we can increase public access. Many, many folks are interested in this particular issue on the Gaviota Coast as it relates to public access anywhere in California. And it's been an interesting process so far, and we hope we will have the opportunity to intervene.
Thank you. Jordan.
See. Test one is, can I turn the mic on? Thank you very much, Chair Laird. And I just wanted to generally thank everyone for the opportunity to serve on the Ocean Protection Council. As Chair Laird described kind of my professional credits for why I've been selected for this position, I will also say I'm born and raised in Northern California on the coast. And I've dedicated my life and my career to environmental issues, specifically kind of marine issues. My focus is really on the intersection of law, science, and policy, which is why I'm so interested in working with the council. Who I think does tremendous work trying to fill the data gaps that we have related to the oceans and coast and that enable really meaningful governance, and really the coordination role that is missing in so many parts of ocean governance in so many parts of the country. The fact that we have a body here really tasked with uniting not just data and law and science and policy, but also between the different entities that use them, between the state agencies, the federal partners, the local partners, the NGOs, and the public. I think that's a really fantastic mission, and I feel very privileged to help contribute to it. So thank you for the opportunity to be here, and look forward to the next 4 years, apparently.
Well, that must mean you have a 5-year term. Any other opening comments from members of the council?
You frightened me off. I heard you loud and clear. I'm not saying anything else.
Whenever Matt says he's been frightened off, you know that's a facetious comment. So I'll turn it over to the executive director for her report. It's item 2.
Thank you, Secretary Laird. Given our packed agenda, I am just going to focus on 2 issues. One is our budget, and one is some staffing changes and additions that we have. So as far as our budget, I think everyone here knows that Prop 68 passed in June. Within Prop 68, the Ocean Protection Council received $56.2 million. $35 million is going to support our work on marine ecosystems, and $21.2 million will support our work on climate change. We received our first appropriation from this fund in July, and we have $10 million for marine ecosystems and $10 million for climate change available to us now. We are currently developing our grant guidelines to be able to release this funding, and we hope to have the draft guidelines available for public review later this summer. We'll host public workshops in the fall, and then we'll bring the final guidelines to the council in February of 2019. We're also making steady progress on our Prop 84 funding. So last August, this council approved the creation of a $7 million competitive grant program, and the application period for preliminary proposals closed in March. We received 240 pre-proposals with a total funding request of $53 million, swamping our $7 million available. We've invited 73 applicants to submit full proposals. Those are due August 10th, and we will be bringing the recommended projects to you for your consideration at the October meeting. If the council approves the three agenda items today to expend Prop 84 funds on sustainable fisheries and water quality projects, we will have approximately $1.7 million left of the initial $80 million in Prop 84. The agenda also includes consideration to authorize disbursement of up to $8.4 million to support eight Prop 1 projects. If all eight are approved, we'll have approximately $2.5 million remaining from that appropriation, with an additional final appropriation of $9.3 million in July 2019. And in addition to all of these bond funds, we also have two new additional sources of funding. So we received a one-time appropriation from the governor's budget of $15 million to address the threats of climate change on coastal and marine ecosystems. And we received a one-time appropriation of $7.5 million to address whale and sea turtle entanglement. That is in addition to the ongoing $2.5 million that we receive for MPA work and the $5.4 million annually through Once Through Cooling. So when you add it up at the end of the day, if the council approves all of the proposed projects today, we will have a little over $100 million moving forward. That's our kind of, not budget, but our monetary status update. As far as staff, I'd like to welcome Holly Shand to our staff. She is our new Associate Governmental Program Analyst, and Holly will be providing contract and grant support to OPC staff and will help assist with logistics for this meeting and for all of our logistic needs. Prior to coming to OPC, Holly worked for CDFW's Marine Region doing grant processing and contracts, and she has experience, fortunately, with the state's new accounting system, Fiscal. I don't have experience with it, so I'm very glad that she does. And she has over a decade's analytical experience in serious injury and claim settlement. We also welcomed on June 25th Nate Marshall, who began his summer fellowship with us at OPC. Nate is a rising junior at Stanford University, and he's studying environmental systems engineering with a focus on coastal and ocean environments. So with us at OPC, we're having him primarily focus on sustainable fisheries, with a dabbling in a little bit of other areas as well. And finally, Sarah Briley, one of our amazing 2017 Sea Grant Fellows, will be leaving OPC at the end of the month to take a position with CDFW in Long Beach as an environmental scientist on their recreational fisheries data project. She'll be working with them to collect marine recreational fishing data and manage marine resources, and we will miss her terribly. She has been just an invaluable member of the OPC climate team, really working on behind-the-scenes number crunching on ocean acidification in a way that is hard to express in words, but we feel it emotionally. So thank you, Sarah. We will miss you, and we wish you all the best.
Well, that's great. We might be science-based, but we feel things emotionally. Are there any questions or comments on the executive director's report? Or further comments? Seeing none, we'll move to item three, which is a report from the science advisor. And I think both Liz and Jay are going to report. We'll begin with Liz.
Thank you, Chair Laird and council members, for the welcome and the opportunity to be here today. I shall consider myself new for as long as I can possibly get away with it. I just wanted to very briefly express that I and the full Ocean Science Trust team look forward to continuing our work to synthesize and share the science that we hope can support you in accelerating progress towards the state's vision for our coast and ocean. In times of change, as these are from so many different perspectives, I think we're all going to be challenged to think creatively to bring new science, new perspectives to the table, including social, a greater emphasis on social and even economic science, if I can put those in the same sentence, and adapt to a changed future. So I am particularly excited by the opportunity to work with you and very closely with the OPC staff to provide definition to this role of science advisor to ensure that it provides value and support for the future. One of the more clarified aspects of this role is to co-chair your science advisory team. Like any good advisor, I think it's not about what you know, but who you know to ask. I think that's a very important aspect that the science advisory team themselves play in reaching out and asking and ensuring that the best science is brought to bear from California and nationally. So I am just going to very quickly say thank you again, and it's great to be here, and pass it to my co-chair, Dr. Jay Stakowitz, for an update.
Thanks, Liz, and thanks, Chair, and members of the Council. Chair did a great job introducing me, so I'll, of course, skip all over all that. But as Liz was saying, I think you all know that our role as the science advisory team is to bring the best available science to you to help you in the decisions that you wrestle with. And we're part of sort of a three-pronged kind of approach with us on the science advisory team, OPC and OPC staff, and of course the Ocean Science Trust as kind of a three-way collaboration that I hope brings you the science that you need to help make decisions. I won't go into a huge amount of detail, but just to brief you quickly on three projects that are ongoing and relevant to the things that you're probably talking about today or will be talking about soon. So you know that we have the Once Through Cooling Working Group report that has just been released this month. This provides some guidance on ways that we can think about how the Once Through Cooling technology has impacted our coast and how also that can perhaps play a role in the decisions that you make about helping protect our investments in marine protected areas and other things. We're also OPC has played sort of a unique role this time around in the California Fourth Climate Assessment. We've worked to with the OPC Science Advisory Team as a working group and OPC staff and OST to produce a coast and ocean report for the Fourth Climate Assessment, which is sort of a new approach this time around. The report is meant to be released in August, and we hope that this can be a sort of science foundation and a platform to help accelerate progress on climate adaptation, which I think touches on many of the things that we deal with here on the Council. And finally, the Ocean Acidification Hypoxia Task Force, which has been convened this year in response specifically to Assembly Bill 2139, and the recommendations, of course, of the West Coast Ocean Acidification Panel. We're sort of using that to actively provide advice to you and to OPC staff as the Council pursues further actions on ocean acidification. The idea here, of course, is to develop both a science roadmap and to support implementation of actions that you see fit for ocean acidification and hypoxia mitigation and amelioration. And so we look forward to updating you on the progress of that as we develop recommendations through that on that project throughout the rest of the year. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, and I look forward to working with all of you.
Thank you both for your reports. Any questions of our science team? Then seeing none, we'll move on to item number 4, which is marine protected areas. It comes in two parts, and presenting on 4A is Cindy Dawson. Cindy?
Good afternoon, Chair Laird and Council members. I'm happy to be here today.
Is that on?
I'm now happy to be here today. to present to you a suite of projects that significantly advances the state's Marine Protected Area, or MPA, management program. The projects you'll hear about today directly address priority needs in monitoring, education, and outreach. So since 2012, when California completed its globally significant network of marine protected areas, under the leadership and direction of Secretary Laird and this council, the state has focused its attention on putting together a comprehensive MPA management program. Data from around the globe supports that in order for marine protected areas to succeed and accrue their maximum ecological benefits, they need to be well managed. And those well-managed MPAs have four components that we have put into action in California and are part of our MPA management program. Those four focal areas include outreach and education, research and monitoring, enforcement and compliance, and policy and permitting. Nested under the research and monitoring focal area is the MPA monitoring program. That program is anchored by three key documents. Those documents include the Marine Life Protection Act Master Plan that was updated in 2016. That's a programmatic guidance document for the entire management program. It's also rooted in the Partnership Program, which is a roadmap the state adopted to lay out a way for us to work with our partners both inside and outside of government. And the last document that really informs this MPA monitoring program is the MPA Statewide Leadership Team Work Plan. This is a document that is a triennial work plan. We're in the process of updating it currently. And it lays out priority consensus tasks in each of the four focal areas, including the MPA monitoring program. So the monitoring program itself has three components that represented by those three bubbles there, science, communication, and evaluation. And it was implemented in two phases. So phase one was baseline monitoring. The MPAs themselves were phased in across the coast. Baseline monitoring did the same. And the focus of baseline monitoring was to establish a comprehensive assessment of conditions that were present at or near the time of implementation. You can see the bubbles on the right-hand side of the slide indicate the eight different habitats that are part of our MPA network, as well as the two types of human use. So this baseline project was really critical and is the foundation of the program because it allows us to track change over time. So it was completed both inside and outside MPAs. It was administered in partnership with California Sea Grant and a whole range of scientific partners. The other thing I want to emphasize on this slide is the whole MPA management program, but certainly the MPA monitoring program, is rooted in partnerships. The actual collection of data was done by the extensive scientific network across the state, and that will be a key component moving forward. And because we're so successful in the baseline, we're set up in a good place to move forward with phase two of the program. The project for consideration in front of you today, item 4A, is the implementation of phase two of the MPA monitoring program. The foundational piece of that program is the MPA action plan. On the slide before you, you'll see the different data streams and components that made up the MPA action plan. There were regional monitoring plans who laid out some of the unique things of each region. There were each of the baseline reports included data recommendations for long-term monitoring from the principal investigators. And over the past 2 years, OPC and others have invested in projects that specifically were designed to establish the best science available in designing a monitoring program that will allow us to evaluate change over time and the performance of the MPA network. This is all angling towards the 2022 10-year management review. So the action plan really lays out the roadmap of how we're going to get there. The draft action plan is currently out for public and peer review, and it was on track to come back to you in October for your consideration for endorsement. So I just want to stop and pause on the action plan because it is such a pivotal part of this phase two implementation and talk about what it does. The action plan lays out the specifics of the metrics, what we're actually going to measure, things like biomass, increases in diversity, It also lays out the species that we're going to monitor. Not only species that will help us evaluate MPAs, but species that can give us information about changing ocean conditions and other priorities for the state. And then because we have 124 marine protected areas, we had to come up with a systematic, scientifically robust way to prioritize the areas that we were going to monitor to ensure that they would tell us about those areas, but also inform the evaluation of the whole network. So, now what this project before you actually does. So first of all, I want to say this is a partnership between the Ocean Protection Council, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and California Sea Grant, who was also a key partner in phase one of this. The project itself will fund the completion of the scientific peer review. We're underway, but we need funds to complete that scientific peer review. Once the action plan comes back to you in October and is adopted, we'll take the findings from that, work in partnership with Sea Grant using their expertise to help us craft an open competitive call for $9.5 million to set the state up with the information it is going to require to inform the evaluation of the network in 2022. We're also going to use Sea Grant's, who is the grantee, the proposed grantee for this project, their expertise to conduct a scientific review of the proposals using best practices. And then we'll bring the recommendations that come out of that scientific peer review back to you in February for consideration. And then we'll move forward and continue to prepare for 2022. I just want to say that this project is a culmination of over a decade of work with the extensive scientific community and stakeholders to set us up to evaluate the performance of the marine protected areas. The project is broadly supported, which you can see reflected in the 16 letters of support you receive for this project. And I'll go ahead and stop there and take any questions you have.
I think we have two items. We have 4B, and I'm going to hear from Tova, okay, and then we can do questions together and action together.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Before I present information on the two projects proposed for item 4B, I'll give a quick overview of what Once Through Cooling is and how we've come to receive these funds. Once Through Cooling technology pulls water from the ocean to cool coastal power plants. And unfortunately, during the process, marine animals, seaweeds, billions of eggs and larvae of fish and invertebrates are taken in with that seawater and are killed or harmed as they're subjected to thermal, physical, and chemical stresses. Larger organisms may also be pinned against the seawater intake screens, causing injury or death. And these impacts contribute to the decline of fisheries and the degradation of marine habitats near the power plants using Once Through Cooling. So to address these damaging impacts, the State Water Resources Control Board established a policy in 2010, which required the power plants to stop using Once Through Cooling technology. Until those power plants transition to less harmful cooling systems, the policy requires the power plant owners and operators to make mitigation payments to the state of California to support projects that will offset the negative ecological effects and increase marine life associated with marine protected areas. MPAs can offset the impacts from Once Through Cooling because we know from MPAs around the world, including California's MPA network, that MPAs can positively affect the reproductive dynamics of a population. Last year, Dr. Jen Cassell from UC Santa Barbara presented to the council about the findings from her studies in the Northern Channel Island MPAs that were put into place in 2003. She found that the MPAs not only had more individuals, but also that those individuals were larger when compared to similar areas outside of the MPAs. So higher densities and increased numbers of larger fish, which are both benefits that we expect to see from MPAs, can provide a significant boost to the population. The policy gives a clear directive that $5.4 million of the annual payments received from this program will support projects that increase the marine life associated with the state's marine protected areas in the geographic region of the facility. This amount was based on an interagency budget analysis conducted by the MPA statewide leadership team about costs associated with the MPA management program that have a direct nexus with once through cooling impacts. Working with the State Water Board, we have developed a process and priorities for OPC's once through cooling interim mitigation program. The mitigation funds that OPC receives annually will support projects that fall into these four categories to achieve the goals of the policy to increase marine life in California's MPA network. In order for MPAs to accrue their maximum ecological benefit, including those that offset once through cooling impacts, ocean users need to be educated about existing regulations, and those regulations need to be enforced. As Cindy mentioned earlier, funding research and monitoring projects will help us understand the level to which our MPA network may be offsetting once through cooling impacts. And finally, the funds will be allocated to restoration projects to determine the level of additional mitigation needed to fully ameliorate the current level of impacts. It's important to note that the Coastal Conservancy will also receive any payments above the $5.4 million allocated to OPC to focus on wetland restoration, which are critical nursery habitats for a wide variety of species and that are also impacted by once through cooling. The projects I'm presenting to you today are centered around the first two categories, education and enforcement. Outreach and education to the public is a critical component of establishing and maintaining compliance with MPA rules and regulations, which in turn maximizes the expected ecological benefits from these areas. This project, for your consideration, would allocate $1,206,515 to the Department of Parks and Recreation to bolster the MPA messaging in their outreach and education programs in seven park districts until 2021. 33% of the state's MPA network is co-located with California State Parks, which provides the opportunity to teach thousands of visitors from across the state and country about marine protected areas and how to understand the regulations. In addition to the campfire programs focused on MPAs and participation in the popular citizen science program MPA Watch, the funding for this program will facilitate several necessary deliverables that will fill current gaps and further strengthen a statewide approach to educate the public about the MPA network. So I'll just highlight a few of the project goals here. One exciting deliverable from this project will expand the Parks Online Resources for Teachers and Students program, also known as PORTS, to include additional MPA messaging and to increase student participation from kindergarten through 12th grade by 40%. This program connects students in their classrooms from across the state to a park ranger in an MPA, live through Skype, and sometimes with a waterproof camera dropped off the side of a kayak to actually see what lives under the water in an MPA, which makes for a truly impactful lesson. The content created for this program will be consistent with next generation science standards and Common Core state standards. This project will also fund the much needed translation of public educational materials, such as brochures, flyers, and signs, into Spanish and Asian languages to reach audiences that may not be receiving important information about MPAs. And finally, these funds will allow the Department of Parks and Recreation to hire a State Park Interpreter 2 position to facilitate the production of all of this new MPA content and programming. The person who fills this position will work closely with OPC, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and other statewide MPA partners, such as the MPA Collaborative Network, to ensure that materials and course content used are consistent and are using approved messaging to produce high-quality MPA programming. The next project deals with MPA enforcement. Enforcement of MPA laws and regulations is essential to ensure a successful MPA network that has the best chance to achieve the ecological goals described in the Marine Life Protection Act. Recurring poaching of marine life in MPAs decreases diversity, population, and reproductive output, and can therefore affect an ecosystem's ability to recover from or mitigate negative impacts, such as those caused by once-through cooling. This project, for your consideration, would allocate $3 million over 3 years to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife Law Enforcement Division to increase the presence of the Marine Enforcement Division to patrol the MPA network statewide to issue violations if they occur and deter them from occurring again. Past department law enforcement efforts, both on land and at sea, have shown that while an enhanced enforcement detail focused on one protected area or geographic region reduces violations in that area, violations increase in other regions not receiving the same attention. So this project addresses this need for consistent enforcement efforts statewide, as a statewide application is the most successful in reducing violations overall. In addition to increasing enforcement patrols in long-range vessels, near-shore vessels, and shore-based patrol areas, the funds for this project will also provide 4 training seminars for the department's law enforcement personnel to review new and existing MPA regulations and to provide guidance on how to best report the contacts and citations in a statewide database. These funds will also be used for critical boat maintenance needed to sustain the efforts of such an increase of patrol hours and ensure that all equipment is in good working order. And finally, these funds will allow the Marine Enforcement Division to outfit 6 offshore vessels with wireless connectivity, which is crucial for reporting and will fill a current need in enforcement efficiency. So to summarize, we know that these programs have a direct benefit to the effectiveness of MPAs, which is strongly supported in the scientific literature. If MPAs are performing at their optimal level, data from around the world and even from our own MPA network strongly support that this directly leads to increases in marine life. And I just want to, you know, drive the point home that OPC is dedicated to a program that uses the best tools at the right locations to invest these funds wisely and to generate the maximum benefit to marine life populations and ocean health. We recommend the projects presented in items 4A and 4B as they are both effective and efficient at meeting the policy's directives. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Nobody has brought me any speaker requests, so I assume we don't have any for this item. Okay. Yeah. Because what I'm going to do before we move to questions and answers is hear from the speakers. So we have a few. So the first one will be Leandra Lopez, and on deck will be Noah Oppenheim.
Good afternoon, Secretary Laird and Council. So I'm going to speak to both items 4A and 4B. The MPA Collaborative Network strongly supports the... Thank you. I'm used to things being taller than me, so I...
Just anyway. For the record, for everybody that's speaking, the mic goes up and down. You can just
Thank you.
Pull it
Thank
right
you.
To you in that moment.
The MPA Collaborative Network strongly supports the staff recommendation for action items 4A, Marine Protected Area Monitoring Program, Phase 2 implementation to inform 2022 MPA Network Management Review, and item 4B. One-suit cooling interim mitigation program, improving enforcement and compliance associated with California's MPA network. The MPA Collaborative Network has been working diligently since its inception in 2012 to engage local communities in the stewardship of California's 124 marine protected areas and encourage ocean stewardship through localized efforts in MPA education and outreach, research and monitoring, and enforcement and compliance. Currently, the MPA Collaborative Network consists of 14 locally operating collaboratives covering all 15 of California's coastal counties. Over 650 members participate, representing 385 organizations, including local agency staff, fishing representatives, tribal members, nonprofit employees, enforcement officers, ocean business owners, community volunteers, educators, and marine scientists. With regards to item 4A, with close to 20% of collaborative membership coming from the scientific and academic communities, this project is integral to maintaining the interest and involvement of local ocean experts and is a crucial step in evaluating the performance of the MPA network. On a broad level, tracking changes in marine protected areas over time will show if marine life is increasing in the geographic regions of California's power plant facilities and will allow for critical examination of the effect of MPAs on habitat resiliency in a time of changing ocean conditions. On a local level, this project has the ability to engage and fund the research of marine scientists and ocean experts who understand and work with the diverse communities depending on the long-term success of the MPA network. With regards to item 4B, each of California's 14 MPA collaboratives have produced multiple outreach tools, including brochures, lectures, videos, teaching tools, and MPA events, some of which you heard about in the recent OPC meeting in the springtime, and have hosted many MPA enforcement trainings for local allied agency officers and district attorneys. Education and outreach
if you'd critical please components. Wrap up. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is Noah, and on deck is Natasha Benjamin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Mr. Secretary, members of the Council. My name is Noah Oppenheim. I'm the Executive Director of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. We are lucky enough to be the largest organization of commercial fishermen and women on the West Coast of the United States, representing 14 port associations here in California. Happy to say that our organization takes as its most important core tenet the support of sustainability in our marine and fisheries resources in California as well as throughout the West Coast. And as a representative organization of the stakeholder group that was most detrimentally affected by the implementation of the marine protected areas in our state's network, I take the effective and comprehensive and high-performing implementation of management measures very seriously. We have a lot to learn about our network, and we have a lot to learn about effectiveness of ways that we can adaptively manage this MPA network. So I am very strongly in support of adequate funding for the scientific mission of this organization and the others that are undertaking study of the MPA network here. And I'm also very encouraged to hear that adaptive management strategies that, in the words of CDFW staff, may include the reassessment of boundaries or of the management of permitted activities within MPAs as part of its approach. So very curious to engage in this process and look forward to commenting on CDFW's adaptive management draft strategy later this month. I'm going to briefly comment on agenda item 4B. With the pending passage of Assembly Bill 2369, which, as many of you may know, is going to significantly step up the punitive actions that the department may take with respect to poaching in MPAs, we strongly encourage the OPC to recommend as part of its training program for wardens the identification of or the differentiation with respect to wardens' use of their discretionary authority to interpret the fishing activities that may or not may not be occurring in marine protected areas due to the willful activities of commercial fishermen. And I'm encouraged to see that additional training is part of this program. Eager to engage further. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next is Natasha Benjamin, and on deck is Ashley Eagle Gibbs.
Thank you to the council members for the opportunity to speak in support of funding for continued monitoring and evaluation of California's marine protected areas. My name is Natasha Benjamin, and I'm the Outreach and Policy Director with Marine Applied Research and Exploration, or MARE. MARE uses robotic technology to document and survey the deep waters of California. We have collected the baseline data for all of the implemented MPA regions in the state, in addition to conducting surveys of statewide nearshore protected areas. The long-term monitoring of California MPAs is critical for consistent data analysis and can inform us of the impact that the state has invested in these protected areas, in addition to it being critical to inform adaptive management as we move forward. MARE has a long-standing partnership with the state for 15 years now, and we continue to work with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to support their monitoring goals. In partnership with the department, MARE has developed data collection protocol, including ROV deployment and video data analysis for monitoring efforts. This effort now has led to surveying 184 sites in California's deep water habitats, from both the MPA baseline process and with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife statewide assessment. Many of these areas have never been visually documented before. Thank you. I'd like to thank the Ocean Science Trust and the OPC for a tremendous baseline assessment effort over the last 10 years. And we would like to support the state efforts to continue phase two of this monitoring, which will allow the continued tracking of changes over time. This will allow the state to evaluate how the MPA network is advancing, including the broad-reaching goals of the state, looking at MPA performance, climate change, and impacts on sustainable fisheries management. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up is Ashley Eagle Gibbs, and on deck is Anna Zivian.
Good afternoon, Chair Laird and Council members. I am the Conservation Director at the Environmental Action Committee of West Marin. Established in Point Reyes Station in 1971, our mission is to protect and sustain the unique lands, waters, and biodiversity of West Marin. Speaking on behalf of Item 4A, we are in strong support of the MPA monitoring program and the launch of Phase 2. It's an important continuation that will allow us to better understand climate change impacts and ecosystem resilience. Our executive director co-chairs the Golden Gate MPA Collaborative, and EAC runs the Marin MPA Watch Program in partnership with the Point Reyes National Seashore and California Academy of Science. This is since 2015. This community science program empowers volunteers and youth to become engaged in their local coastal areas as citizen scientists. MPA Watch, as mentioned earlier, MPA Watch recently made it into the Department of Fish and Wildlife's draft action plan, and this is a real victory for the MPA Watch to be considered part of this long-term monitoring program, and we're in support of the action plan. Just speaking very briefly on item 4B, we're in strong support of OPC funding to enhance MPA education, compliance, and enforcement within California's MPA network. Education and enforcement are key components of the program, and this funding is critical to the program's success. In particular, we support OPC staff's recommendation to use part of the $1.2 million of the OTC mitigation funds to train 5 full-time park staff to be MPA Watch trainers and submit surveys at least 3 times annually. Thank you very much for your support of our globally significant MPAs.
Thank you very much for your comments. Next is Anna Zivian, and then on deck is Caitlin Gaffney.
Good afternoon, Chair Laird and members, and hi, Jordan, and welcome. Nice to have you here. Long-term monitoring and enforcement are critical to maintain effective networks of MPAs and to provide benefits to marine species and California communities. As an organization that helped set up the MPA network, Ocean Conservancy is very much in support of long-term monitoring and enforcement items 4A and 4B. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. And then Caitlin Gaffney. You don't have to get lower.
Shall I step back? Good afternoon, Chair Laird and members of the council. Caitlin Gaffney with the Resources Legacy Fund. As many of you know, our organization has been a partner with the state on now a 14-year effort to establish and effectively manage the Marine Protected Area Network. I will be brief. I am here to speak in support of items 4A and 4B. I think your staff did an incredible job in putting all of this effort together, a good staff report today, but as Cindy mentioned, this is really reflecting 10 years of background effort to figure out what are the most important components to effective MPA management and monitoring, and I think that's exactly what you have before you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now the matter is back to the council for any questions and then action. Or do we have any questions? Michael.
Thank you both for an excellent presentations, and this is really an important facet of what the council can do in ongoing support and enhancement of the MPA and protection of the MPA network. I have a couple of questions specifically around the outreach and education. One of the questions is, give me a little more explanation of how these particular outreach and educational activities were chosen and how they specifically relate to the compliance and enforcement issues that we're facing today and could face in the future. And the related question is, is there any plan for evaluating the effectiveness of these particular outreach and education activities in terms of future compliance and enforcement? So I see lots of K through 12, which in general is great idea. I'm having trouble seeing how that specifically relates to current problems today and how you're going to measure whether these particular things are effective going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for those questions. I'll address the second question first. So specifically about the K through 12 education aspect, so the 1.2 million for education to the Department of Parks and Recreation, the K through 12, the PORTS program, is just one component of this overall grant or contract, rather. And we're really excited about that aspect because from success of the parks programs in the past, it's shown that the students get really excited about these types of lessons and then bring that information back to their parents, and then especially when they're visiting these parks and MPAs that are co-located with these parks, those in the park programming are really important to be able to convey that information. So another thing that this contract with the Department of Parks and Recreation definitely fills a gap that is needed is that there's a lot of information provided about MPAs once you arrive to the park, but this contract would help fill gaps to provide the information before they even come to the park or to the MPA. So that's one area where we're filling with this contract. In terms of your first question, these projects specifically in both enforcement and education were chosen based on the highest priority needs determined by the MPA statewide leadership team's work plan. These were gaps that needed to be filled, and this, once through cooling funds, allow those very important critical components for that need to be filled to be funded. For example, the enforcement component of the funding, there's, as I mentioned, we would be outfitting six vessels with wireless connectivity that they currently don't have, and that's a really important aspect to be able to send the information from out at sea back to the database. So and we don't currently have that in our enforcement plan right now. Excuse me. Was there another part of the?
I'll just add one
okay.
More so just about the long-term effects of this project. Yeah. So the Department of Fish and Wildlife is bringing on a records management system. that is going to be location specific and connected. And so one of the things that we're going to do with these education projects is we're going to be tracking compliance in these co-located MPAs and across the state. We also have accountability built into actually the education projects, sort of before and after surveys and those types of things, so we can try to get a handle. We've talked to social scientists, and it's a challenge to figure out exactly how to do that, but we're using the best available knowledge and working with people to really get that accountability and try to at least get some correlation, if not causality, between these education programs and potentially improve compliance, which is what we're all shooting for.
Can I ask a follow-up? Because I get how you just described that, but how do you actually do it?
Yeah, so, I mean, location is part of that, right? So actually tracking the compliance in each of the MPAs, and the record management system is going to do that in a way we haven't really been able to do before. The education component, like how that carries forward in improving compliance, there are some social science techniques, survey techniques, actually surveying people out in the field, those types of things. I mean, it's basically survey based, what I've been told by social scientists. And again, Parks is really interested in this, and enforcement is really interested. So it would be probably a survey based model.
I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I still don't understand what that means. So for example, what it sounds like you're trying to do is there's education, mm-hmm. and there's outreach, mm-hmm. and what is the correlation between people mm-hmm. that either experience it and don't respond, or people that don't experience it and still offend? I'm not sure how the connection gets made.
So there could be, and there could be a way for, if an enforcement action is being taken, I mean, we could work with enforcement to add an additional question on the, you know, when they're interviewing somebody who may be violating, did you know about this, whatever. We can also talk to people that are doing extractive uses or potentially violating. It's a survey-based model. I mean, you have to get in the field and actually ask people if they know about them. It works better if it's not an enforcement officer doing that. MPA Watch is also a way to help us get some information about that. MPA Watch documents human use in these areas. So it's not a straight line. Absolutely.
One of the things that sort of was inferred and not said clearly is due to the efforts such as Caitlin Gaffney was talking about over time, this with Fish and Wildlife was entirely a paper, non-digital interface with enforcement. And now that every enforcement officer over time will have an iPad or something to where they can pull up a prior record, or you can immediately digitalize this so that you have statistics and names and you know. Are you drawing conclusions from the fact that you have a database that'll be coming now rather than just a bunch of paper records?
Yeah, certainly that will be part of it. I think that in addition, there's information that we can gain from the MPA Watch program that tracks human use in those areas. So you put the records management together with the MPA Watch program, and I think we're going to have a better chance over time. And there are also studies around the world that, again, it's just a correlation, but basically when programs like the ones that are part of this education project are implemented at the scale that we're going to be implemented, compliance tends to go up. And so, again, it's correlation. It's hard to draw that direct line, but I think we have accountability built into the project.
And going back to Michael, did you have a chance to ask both the questions you wanted to ask?
I did, and I'm asking the questions from the perspective of more or less every dollar that we have available to spend should generate the most effective action for it. And I'm not quibbling with your choices here, but trying to encourage you guys to look not just at what people say is, this is really a need, but is it something that actually is going to translate, as Chairman Laird was trying to ask you, translate into better compliance. And I think, thank you for your answer, Cindy, that more and more we should be trying to do education and outreach that we're pretty confident is really effective at achieving a particular goal. So that's the basis of my questions, and you know, I hope we're there on this. And if it isn't, that's okay. But let's recognize, let's do the work and recognize and change where things aren't that effective.
Well, if it isn't, we'll now have the information to determine that it isn't and that we should be taking an alternate course of action. Are there further questions or comments? Then let me say, I think these are good proposals, and I would suggest a motion that adopts the findings as recommended by staff, approves the projects as described, and delegates to the executive director the authority to implement.
So
moved. Motion, second. Further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you for your presentations. And we'll move to item number five. On the sustainable fisheries side of item number five, Paige is going to be presenting. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Item five presents three projects for council consideration. One would be supported by 2018-2019 environmental license plate funds, and two projects would be supported by Proposition 84 funds. The 2018-19 environmental license plate funds may be used to address the threats of climate change on coastal and marine ecosystems and communities. Item 5A recommends a sustainable fisheries project that advances innovation in the support of climate change resilience in fisheries and fishing communities, among other objectives. Proposition 84 funds may be used for a wide range of purposes, including promoting the sustainability of marine fisheries and scientific research to inform management. OPC staff relies on guidance documents, legislation, agency leadership, and emerging science to identify potential priority projects. As projects are developed, staff uses a collaborative vetting process. The first project would provide up to $143,000 to Manta Consulting to support a California track of Fish 2.0. Fish 2.0 is a global program that seeks to incubate innovative seafood businesses through a series of training and workshops, helping businesses grow and scale with a priority on strengthening their positive and social impact. The program builds partnerships between seafood businesses, public agencies, investors, expert advisors, and NGOs to catalyze sustainable growth of fisheries businesses. The Fish 2.0 is a global program which consists of various regional tracks, and OPC would support a California-based track. Through sponsoring a California track, OPC would have a key role in outlining specific focus areas and eligibility criteria for participating California seafood businesses. An OPC-sponsored track would target California businesses that focus on 1, increasing traceability and transparency in seafood supply chains, 2, innovations in seafood supply chains that favor sustainability, local food systems, and fishing communities, and 3, increasing resilience to impacts from climate change through innovative tools, technology, and approaches. OPC will coordinate closely with state agency and other partners through the development of the California track. Sponsorship of this track will include participation in the global event, which will elevate OPC's priorities at a global scale. The goal of OPC's Sustainable Fisheries Program is to enhance the sustainability of California's ocean fisheries to protect marine ecosystems, port communities, and coastal economies. This project will directly benefit sustainable fisheries businesses in addition to OPC's direct support of commercial fishing businesses through the California Fisheries Fund. Exhibit D of this item includes support letters from sustainable seafood businesses that have either participated in the program and/or expressed interest in participating in a California track. To highlight one example, Real Good Fish, based out of Moss Landing, participated in the 2013 Fish 2.0 program. In 2013, Real Good Fish was 1 year old with 300 customers supporting 20 California fishermen. Fish 2.0 helped Real Good Fish hone their business model and grow to serve over 1,500 families, and individuals with seafood provided from over 100 California fishermen. Their newest program, called Bay to Tray, serves California fish to California students. Catalyzing sustainable growth of fisheries businesses is an important additional strategy to management and policy strategies to effect change and ensure sustainable fisheries and ensure sustainable fisheries for future generations. I'm happy to answer any questions at this time, and Monica Jane and Remy Garderay from Fish 2.0 can also answer any questions if you'd like to take questions now.
Thank you. No, I think we're going to go through 5A, 5B, and 5C, and then do speakers and questions and action. So I think you're up for 5B.
Still me. Yeah. Okay, so the second project would provide up to $280,000 to Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission to coordinate implementation of electronic monitoring systems on a suite of commercial fishing vessels participating in a box crab experimental gear permit research program. In April 2018, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife determined the fishery for non-cancer crab, which includes the brown box crab species or box crab as well as king crab, to be an emerging fishery as defined by Fish and Game Code Section 7090 of the Marine Life Management Act. The Fish and Game Commission is required to encourage, manage, and regulate emerging fisheries. Fish and Game noticed a proposed regulation change at their June 2018 meeting to limit incidental harvesting of non-cancer crab and trap fisheries, as the increase in incidental take of non-cancer crabs, and particularly of box crab, had spiked in recent years. Simultaneously, Fish and Game Commission directed the Department of Fish and Wildlife to pursue development of an experimental gear permit program for box crab specifically, which will allow fishermen to target box crab while also requiring collaboration with the state on research. As part of this collaborative research with the state that will be advanced through the experimental gear permit program, the state is exploring testing different electronic monitoring systems to gather important information regarding species biology, fishing dynamics, and bycatch. The project will capitalize on the strategic opportunity to test electronic monitoring systems to meet both the immediate need and goal of data collection to inform fishery development, as well as the ultimate goal of providing guidance on the use of electronic monitoring more broadly in the state. OPC's support of this project would fund electronic monitoring tools, observers, data review and analysis from electronic monitoring tools, as well as convening an advisory committee of participating fishermen, state agency staff, Pacific States Marine Fishery Commission staff, and other experts. Outcomes of this pilot project include 1, determining whether box crab is a viable and sustainable target fishery, and 2, guidance for the state's potential broader application of electronic monitoring as a fisheries management tool. And I will now turn it over to Holly to present item 5C.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paige. The third project for your consideration today is assembling, facilitating, and administering an expert panel to update monitoring recommendations for emerging contaminants in coastal waters. This project is coming to you from the Marine Pollution Program. Oh, thank you. which addresses 4 broad categories of contaminants: trash, contaminants of emerging concern, microbiology, and nutrients. This project would fall under the contaminants of emerging concern category. Staff recommends providing just under $163,300 to the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project to implement this project. The goal of convening this panel would be to update the monitoring recommendations for coastal waters from 2012. OPC staff has worked with the Water Board and the Department of Toxic Substances Control while building up this project, and will continue to coordinate with these agencies and other interested stakeholders moving forward to shape the management questions that the panel would address. Funding provided by the OPC would be leveraged by around $58,000 from the Water Board to enable the panel to provide recommendations for both freshwater environments in addition to marine environments. The recommendations from this project would be used by the Water Board to identify and prioritize emerging contaminants for monitoring in coastal environments based on potential risks to marine life. The recommendations would also inform the development of the Water Board's Contaminant of Emerging Concern Initiative, which is a statewide management strategy to coordinate efforts around these contaminants. Finally, the Department of Toxic Substances Control would also use the panel's recommendations to help prioritize product chemical combinations for consideration under their Safer Consumer Products Program. This program looks at whether chemicals used in consumer products may cause negative environmental or human health impacts. Thank you for your attention. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call on the speakers, and then we'll go to questions. And the first one is Noah Oppenheim, and Alexis Jackson is on deck. And there were some people that last time requested to speak on different items of four twice and then combine their comments. We didn't have that this time, but just feel free to address 5A, 5B, 5C in your comments. Thank you, Noah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the council. Thanks for the opportunity. Noah Oppenheim with the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. I'll just very briefly comment on item 5A and express our organization's support for the Fish 2.0 initiative. This is a great opportunity to leverage outside funding for what I believe is an important project, an important opportunity to support coastal communities and infrastructure development in particular under the second category under this California TRAC program. So I'll wrap up there and ask for your support of this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Then Alexis Jackson is up and Julia Coates is on deck.
Good afternoon. Alexis Jackson with the Nature Conservancy. The Nature Conservancy has been committed to ensuring sustainable fisheries and healthy marine ecosystems through working collaborative partnerships, increasing the quality and quantity of data that's available to inform management decisions, and also catalyzing innovation through on-the-water experimentation. And so for this reason, we're really encouraged by the progress that the state is making towards modernizing its data systems, and also into integrating data into or technology into its management approaches. And so as this pilot moves forward, we're definitely very strongly supportive of seeing the box crab pilot move forward and encouraged by the use of electronic monitoring. But we would encourage the Ocean Protection Council and the department to continue to facilitate frequent outreach to and leveraging the expertise of stakeholders who have experience in both work on electronic monitoring and also on machine learning. And additionally, as we continue to kind of maximize our learnings from both this pilot and work moving into the future and looking at emerging fisheries, we want to make sure that we're also making parallel investments to ensure that we're advancing electronic reporting for the existing fisheries and making sure that we're making advancements on collection of fundamental data such as catch data streams that would come from modernizing reporting systems such as electronic logbooks. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Julia Coates is up, and Natalie Kalk is on deck.
Good afternoon, Chair Laird and council members. My name is Julia Coates. I'm with the Department of Fish and Wildlife's Marine Region. I want to express support for Item 5B, the Box Crab Pilot Project. Implementing electronic monitoring on board in this experimental fishery will support fishing communities in two different ways. First, by greatly improving our efficiency in data collection and our studies of the potential for box crab to be a sustainable new fishing opportunity. And second, by testing multiple different electronic monitoring tools, we can provide guidance to the state on future implementation of these tools in other contexts to further the goals of more efficiently managing our existing fisheries, in addition to seeking additional new fishing opportunities in the future. So thanks for your consideration of the project.
Thank you very much. Next is Natalie Kalk, and on deck is Anna Zivian.
Good afternoon, council members. I'm Natalie Kalk, Program Manager for California Coastkeeper Alliance. CCKA submitted written comments prior to this meeting with Surfrider Foundation, Heal the Bay, Ocean Conservancy, and California Marine Sanctuary Foundation. We're in support of OPC funding to convene an expert panel to update monitoring recommendations for CECs in coastal waters. I want to thank OPC for their leadership to invest in CEC research for the benefit of aquatic life. The OPC's engagement on monitoring CECs for aquatic health is critical because to date, the State Water Board's CEC monitoring protocols are solely focused on public health and not on threats to aquatic life. Meanwhile, thousands of new chemicals are created daily and discharged into our waterways through treated wastewater and polluted runoff. This project would allow OPC to provide State Water Board with timely guidance and recommendations to require CEC monitoring in coastal marine environments. I should note that CCKA is also strongly supporting and encouraging State Water Board members to support funding necessary to develop similar protocols for CEC monitoring in inland waters. Stakeholder participation will be vital throughout this project, and we strongly support OPC's plan to meet with State Water Board staff, the Department of Toxic Substances Control staff, and other interested agencies and stakeholders to refine the management questions that the panel will address. We thank you for your commitment to this issue. And on the topic of water quality, I want to mention that today is Swimmable California Day, which was designated by the...
Is what California Day?
Swimmable.
Swimmable.
It was designated by the California legislature 5 years ago to recognize all Californians' right to clean and safe waters for swimming. And thanks to OPC for your continued action to ensure that our ocean and coasts are safe to enjoy. And happy Swimmable California Day. Thank you.
The only... legislator that is sitting up here that probably voted for that swam the English Channel, so he believes in things being swimmable. He gets some credit. Anna Zivian, Ann Cooper Doherty on deck.
Hi, Anna Zivian, Senior Research Fellow, Ocean Conservancy, in support of item 5C. Contaminants of emerging concern are exactly that, and setting up this expert panel at SQRP is timely and necessary and will provide vital information for California and beyond. Thank you very much.
So we have Ann Cooper Doherty, and then I apologize if I don't pronounce the name of the person on deck. Tessa Foget is next up.
Hi, I'm Ann Cooper Doherty. I'm a senior environmental scientist with the Department of Toxic Substances Control, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment on this. DTSC is strongly supportive of proposed funding for item 5C, the expert panel on CECs. The Safer Consumer Products Program is committed to reducing and eliminating the use of toxic chemicals by listing product chemical combinations that manufacturers must evaluate for safer alternatives. Our recent work plan, one of the goals for that work plan, was to protect California's valuable and limited water resources and aquatic ecosystems from consumer product-derived chemicals. And given our limited resources, an evaluation of CECs that may be of concern for California by this expert panel would be really of a lot of value to our program. We really also appreciate the opportunity to work with other stakeholders to develop the management questions, and we think that this will help ensure that the panel is considering questions whose answers can help programs like ours to mitigate the impact of CECs in the aquatic ecosystem, as SCP can take true source control measures, which helps alleviate the stress on wastewater treatment plants and other municipalities to remove CECs at the point of discharge and instead puts it back at the source, which is a much more effective route. And our regs also allow for addressing even data-poor chemicals, which we hope is something that the panel would consider in their evaluation. And we believe this is a mutually beneficial endeavor, and we look forward to seeing it implemented. And we thank you for your commitment to protecting the coastal marine ecosystems. Thank you.
Thank you. And then Tessa.
You actually did a great job on my name, so thank you. So I'm Tessa Foget. I'm the lead staff on constituents of emerging concern in the Division of Water Quality at the State Water Board. And we support the staff recommendation to convene an expert panel on emerging contaminants. I just want to say we've had a very positive experience working with OPC staff to develop their recommendation, and we'll continue collaborating closely with staff if the funding is approved. We agree that this is a good time to convene this expert panel on emerging contaminants in aquatic ecosystems. We just recently convened an expert panel on CECs in recycled water that was very focused on human health, and we are ready to take our next step and focus again on aquatic health. And, you know, our last panel that we had convened was in 2012 on aquatic ecosystems, so we also agree it's time for an update. We are currently working on developing a funding agreement to cover the freshwater portion of the expert panel. So we do have funding available to do that, as Holly mentioned. And we greatly appreciate the collaborative effort to fund this work because, in general, we don't have a dedicated resource pool for emerging contaminants. So leveraging our resources with OPC provides great value for both agencies as well as other agencies and the people of California in general. We really appreciate building in the opportunity to develop the management questions, working with other agencies and stakeholders, including OPC and Department of Toxic Substance Control, because partnering with these other agencies, as mentioned, can really get at true source control to change the use of some of these chemicals. And I just want to mention, Holly kind of gave an overview that we expect these recommendations to be used by Water Board's monitoring programs, such as our San Francisco Bay Regional Monitoring Program and our Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program and others that are capable of implementing CEC monitoring and management actions, and will also serve to inform our CEC initiative, which is our statewide CEC management strategy that we are currently developing. So just I'll leave it at that, and we support the proposal. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Now it is back to the council for questions and action. Are there any questions? Michael, what were you interested, Jordan? Okay.
I should comment that I didn't know there was a safe and swimmable day adopted by the legislature. And although I may not have been a legislator, I'm probably the only person up here who has paddled out to go surfing at a break in Chair Laird's hometown that is colloquially known as Sewer Peak. And there's it would have been nice to have had this.
What thing. Year was that?
When were you and I at UCSC?
Sewer Peak has been
dismantled?
It's out of use.
Ah, okay. Otherwise known as the top of Pleasure Point, or formerly.
When I began at the county, which is in Jurassic times, they did not put the unified system in, and they actually had a stand on the bluff, and they put green dye in, and we saw where it came out not far
from where I was sitting.
Which is what you were describing. Now it's in a unified system. It's treated at a much
Lovely.
Higher level, and it goes 12,000 feet out.
Safe and swimmable, surfable. I do have a comment for staff and SCORP. In terms of the expert panel, I don't see this as purely a technical evaluation. I've been involved with some emerging contaminant issues over the years, and there is always the question of how emergent is the emerging chemicals. And that's way more of a values question and even arguably an economic social issue. And I'll just give one example of it. Perfluorochemistry has been an issue for a really long time, and it's only now getting some traction. A number of years, people were quietly raising the issue and focused on 3M Scotchgard product. And this is now going back to almost 20 years. And 3M obviously is really invested in that product and just fought, like in a lot of situations, where to hang on to the product and hang on to product as formulated. And at some point, they just caved and withdrew it. From one perspective, great, it's a victory. But that chemistry, I mean, nothing really changed. There wasn't a whole lot of other issues. It's just a question of it hadn't really reached public consciousness until there was a lot of publicity. And then all of a sudden, people wanted to act on it. And I'm just suggesting that we think broadly about the expert panel to bring perspectives to it where emerging, it's way harder to clean up a problem the deeper it gets into the social and economic fabric of California. But it's way harder to remove that problem without it being generally in the public's consciousness. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Jordan?
Thank you. First, thank you, Paige and Holly, for those presentations. I'll start off by saying I'm strongly supportive of all three projects, but I do have just a clarifying question about 5B. And I'm going to apologize in advance because I have about a three-second memory, but I think it was Alexis Jackson, if I got the name correctly. I'm strongly in support, actually, of her comments about coordinating with kind of other entities, and I was wondering if you could just speak to any plans in the project kind of for the council to kind of coordinate with other entities who have expertise either in electronic monitoring or experimental fisheries programs generally.
Yeah, I'm happy to comment on that, and I agree that I think that was an important comment. And so to provide a little bit of context on the box crab experimental gear program so far, just last week, I believe on July 17th, the Fish and Game Commission had a Marine Resources Committee meeting where Julia provided a overview of the framework of the experimental gear program. So just to comment that this conversation is happening in various agency spaces where stakeholders can formally comment. And in addition to that, in April, there was a meeting with interested stakeholders to discuss the beginnings of the box crab experimental gear permit program with fishermen and other interested stakeholders. And I think it will be really important going forward to continue to ensure that collaboration is there for anyone who didn't make the April meeting or hasn't been aware of the processes, and especially to reach out to those who have expertise in electronic monitoring systems. Since this is a pilot project and really hasn't been tested recently at the state, that's going to be essential.
Terrific. Right. Thank you. I appreciate the information. And yeah, to the extent that we can continue thinking about those outreach opportunities, it'd be great.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Other questions? Then let me ask one for Holly. And it, you know, three people in the water world understand emerging contaminants and what it means. And let me ask a more focused question, because when we had a presentation from Professor Rafe Cadella, and it related to the, at the time, the things that were going on off of Sonoma and Mendocino with the fish die-off and the reduced oxygen, and then also ocean acidification, he said something that when I offered my usual riff that ocean acidification is mostly from carbon in the atmosphere, but near shore contaminants due to agriculture, he corrected me and said the emerging research is also that the sewer outfalls for municipal areas are also as much responsible as the ag runoff. So when we're looking at updating monitoring recommendations, is that part of what is being taken into account here? Is that what we're getting at with this?
These monitoring recommendations would be for, I guess they would be for contaminants that come out of sewage outfalls, but they would be from things like personal care products or pharmaceuticals. We are, and I think Jen can speak more to this, we are in the process of funding a model that will be comparing those different inputs of nutrients, which also come from sewer outfalls, and how much they contribute to ocean acidification versus other sources of local runoff.
See, because the Water Board historically had certain ways that it measured or looked at treated sewage from outfalls, and I didn't know if the fact that the science is starting to change a little, there had been talk about the Water Board looking at it in a different way, and so I'm just trying to get at whether those are conventional contaminants and not merging, and therefore they're not part of this, or whether that is part of this in some way.
The nutrients are conventional contaminants. Yes.
So those are just everyday contaminants, and we might not be getting at it through this study. So, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so those wouldn't be covered in this panel, but we are planning to do more work on them when that model run is finished, and we have that as a baseline to go from in terms of where we want to put
it. Well, you see, I can see that Secretary Rodriguez is leaning toward his microphone, and maybe he wishes to offer something, but if he doesn't, I'll ask the question of staff. Why not? Secretary.
Well, it relates back also to the comments that were made by Councilmember Brown. You know, what we have is a number of programs in the state that will look at chemicals in various contexts. And, in fact, when this question came up of the contaminants of emerging concern, I asked the question, and I don't know if it's directly related to the testimony that we got from DTSC and from the State Water Board today, but it was, you know, how does this relate to the other programs that we have looking at chemicals? Because one of the things that I've become very tired of hearing about in my time as secretary was people saying, well, you're all siloed. I said, no, that's the point of a council such as this one, the Ocean Protection Council, maybe the other councils, to make sure that government entities are working together and to make sure that our programs are complementary. In this case, and PFOA is a good example of that, right now we're looking at PFOA and the perfluorinated chemicals in a whole variety of contexts. We're looking at it as drinking water contamination, which is how it's really emerged most recently, and US EPA raised this a couple of years ago. But we're also looking at it as chemical in our consumer products, so the Safer Consumer Products Program is looking at PFOA and PFOS. I think we need to look at it as a contaminant in some of our areas of the state where it's been used as a flame retardant. So there are a variety. So what we... It's sort of an answer to your question. These chemicals may be emerging as a concern in a variety of different areas, depending on what we learn about them as time goes on. And so our goal is to make sure that all these programs are complementary, that we're not duplicating each other's efforts. But we were, as you mentioned, there are, I think, 85,000 chemicals out there. There are 40,000 that are in everyday use. And analysis has been done on a very, very small percentage of them. So these programs, our effort is to make sure that they're complementary and that the information that we developed as we look at it in different contexts all fits together so that we have a holistic view of these chemicals at some point. I would say that the Water Board has identified a couple of chemicals, and, you know, our focus really has been on fertilizers and that sort of thing. And so we've been focusing on that, but we know there are other chemicals out there that we need to take a look at. I think that this work will inform that other work that we're doing, and so that we will come together and have a better picture of what chemicals should we be looking at over time. And combining that information, I think, will be helpful.
And I think that's a very helpful response, and that is a great context because I believe we should approve these three. But for anybody that's listening, that larger discussion mm-hmm. of the people that should not be in silos that work for both of us, mm-hmm. We have to make sure that we look at those different pieces of mm-hmm. it and that it just doesn't fall through in mm-hmm. some way. And I know that it'll happen anyway because of the acidification and hypoxia, but, and as usual, as I'm always fond of saying, never happen within my lifetime or at the time that I think that it should happen. But I can't remember if I said before the the last meeting that when I marched in the Science March, I don't know if I mentioned that, I marched in the Science March in Santa Cruz, and they're doing a chant about what do we want, science, and when do we want it now, and then somebody would shout, with peer review. At the end of it, I thought, oh, no, it just spun out for a long a period of time. So I the Rafe Cadella comments were very meaningful to me, and so I really hope that that as part of this, we just make sure, because the Water Board's process is lengthy, and if they are going to adjust to deal with that in terms of sewer treatment and other things, we need to figure out the right way to get the science and the inputs to for them to have a meaningful process.
Yeah, I don't want to belabor the point, but these issues are very, very complicated. I just went through an analysis with some of the scientists in another department within EPA where they said, well, we only look at the human health risks. We don't do environmental evaluations of risks. Our role is to make sure that we're pulling all that information together. PFOA and PFAS, as I said, is a good example. I neglected to mention that, you know, OEHA is looking at it as well. And so there's a good example of how you've got, you know, four different agencies looking at it from slightly different angles. Our goal is to make sure that we bring all that information together so that we can make informed decisions that look at a chemical through its entire lifespan. You know, how's it developed? How's it used? What happens when it is no longer in use or when it winds up in our sewers? What's affected? Who's affected? Is it humans? Is it the environment? And so, you know, we try to be conscious of that, and I think that they've done a good job in this situation of bringing all those issues together.
I hope whoever in 2003 and 4 authored the Ocean Protection Act is listening to know that their goal of silos being broken down was totally mirrored in this conversation and this action. Any further comments? I would suggest almost an identical motion that we approve the findings, the staff recommendation on the projects, and direct the executive director to implement this motion.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much. And we appreciate everybody's comments on that. We'll move to item number 6, which is the consideration of authorization to disperse Proposition 1 funds. And Marina, over to you.
Trying to time myself to make sure I'm pithy. Good afternoon.
Don't time yourself. Just be pithy.
Good afternoon, Chair Laird and council members. My name is Marina Cazorla, and I am an Ocean Protection Council program manager overseeing the Proposition 1 grant program. Before I discuss the 8 proposed projects recommended by staff today, I'd like to briefly review the progress of OPC's Prop 1 grant program this far. The first grant round was completed in June 2016, when 8 projects were approved by the OPC, totaling $7.3 million. There was an update and a revision to the OPC Prop 1 guidelines last year in November, and we began a second grant round with an RFP in December, which concluded with site visits this June. Unfortunately, and in total, staff received 28 applications requesting $29 million with only $11 million available of this funding type. Unfortunately, we received no applications for our special small grants pilot, where we were trying to encourage projects that were less than $250,000. Those were intended for disadvantaged communities and or small-scale pilot projects. So briefly, I'd like to offer you a little bit of background on staff's proposal review and evaluation process. I can figure out the clicker here.
Oh, that font is not what it was. staff assembled a review committee consisting of OPC staff and 12 external reviewers. We used the scoring criteria that was provided in the grant guidelines, and the reviewers scored each proposal based on those criteria. Each proposal had no fewer than 5 reviewers discussing each proposed project, and we had both an interim review committee meeting and a final meeting where we made final recommendations collectively on which projects were to be invited to host site visits. We then had site visits at 14 project sites in May and June, and that was the last component of the competitive process. And final decisions for staff recommendations that you are seeing today were made by the executive director. So the next slide is a map. We wanted to just show you where all of the 8 proposed projects are located. So from north to south, you'll see the inset at the upper right-hand part of the slide shows you the Elk River, Martin Slough, and Eel River projects. And going down the coast southward, there is a project in San Francisco Bay, Elkhorn Slough, which is in the Central Coast, Morro Bay, Surfers Point in Ventura, and finally Quincy Jones in Los Angeles.
I mean, Quincy Jones is more than a name. It's a beach, right?
Indeed.
Okay, it is just so that's clear.
It is a would-be green
alley. So it's not at
alley.
His house somewhere in West LA. Yeah.
I would be delighted to work with Mr. Jones. But so I'd like to just quickly review each of the proposed projects in the order that they've been placed on the agenda. Please note that I've included the item number in the upper right-hand corner of each slide just for your reference. So the Quincy Jones Green Alley Stormwater Infiltration Project is located in a part of Los Angeles that is in a disadvantaged community. The map in the upper left-hand corner shows both the project location in the roughly the center of the red area. And the project will consist of a 2-block green alley that will be part of a larger green alley network that has been prioritized by the City of Los Angeles, the Trust for Public Land, and the Strategic Growth Council, among others. There is demonstrated community support and engagement in the form of 6 years of volunteer efforts working since the Avalon Green Street pilot project was completed. The project will consist of dry wells, permeable pavers, infiltration trenches and planters, vine and tree plantings, catch basin and trash receptors, street trees, trash receptacles, art, interpretive signage, and funder acknowledgement. And then the next project in Morro Bay is located on State Parks land in the Morro Bay State Park Marina, which borders the Morro Bay National Estuary and 2 marine protected areas, the Morro Bay State Marine Recreation Area and the Morro Bay State Marine Reserve. So in this area, water quality is degraded by increasing urbanization, and Morro Bay is listed as impaired for multiple pollutants. The slope and design of the degraded parking lot and accompanying failed culverts are shunting untreated sediment-laden stormwater directly, untreated, into the estuary. And you'll see that in the upper left-hand photo. So this stormwater issue is causing public health risks, economic impacts, and declines in marine resources. The estuarine areas are showing signs of damage, and the estuary the water quality has frequently fallen below standards, resulting in exposure warnings, algal blooms, and sea otter deaths. So this project would support the planning and installation of stormwater pollution prevention infrastructure, which will include regrading the incline of the parking lot away from the marina, as illustrated in the lower right-hand drawing, and back towards the center of the lot, towards the line of trees that borders the road. And subsurface equipment will be installed that is a combination of stormwater catch basins and infiltration beds. And that
water will be pumped into a bioremediation field just upland of the parking lot on the other side of the road. And the partners for that are not just state parks, but the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, California Coast Keepers, the Coastal San Luis RCD, the Resources Conservation District, and the California Marine Sanctuary Foundation. So the next project in Eel River, going back up to the north coast, is going to restore tidal prism to 115 acres of the Eel River estuary, creating 3.5 acres of aquatic habitat and complexity, and improving the reliability and ecological performance of tide gate infrastructure. It will also restore migratory access to 1.5 miles of restored aquatic habitat for freshwater and marine species, including more than 1 mile of historic Centerville Slough and the Rust Creek connection to the estuary, fish species of tribal, commercial, and sport importance will benefit, including green sturgeon, and it will also provide habitat for waterfowl and other wildlife. Next project, Elkhorn Slough in the Central Coast, which is, as you'll see in the lower left-hand part of the slide in the middle of Monterey Bay, so the slough already represents a high level of biodiversity, species, and abundance and ecological functions, but the project area now consists of high mud flats, which are prone to eutrophication and are areas that formerly hosted salt marsh, but have since subsided after the area was historically diked and drained. This caused subsidence, and when the dikes failed, the area was too low to support a healthy marsh. So unfortunately, right now, the mudflats do not serve the valuable ecological function that other mudflats do because they lack the abundance and diversity of invertebrates that are needed. And also, if you look at the center photo on the bottom, you'll see, or in the middle actually, you'll see the white algal mats that are caused by the eutrophication in that particular part of the area. So in total, the proposed project will complete the last 30 acres of a 91-acre tidal marsh restoration in the Hester Marsh area of Elkhorn Slough and will add approximately 100,000 cubic yards of sediment to bring the marsh back to a sustainable elevation. This will restore lost habitat, improve water quality, reduce tidal scour, sequester carbon, and enhance climate change resilience. In fact, the first phase of the project is already underway, and with high king tides, a brief flood of newly graded land spontaneously repropagated pickleweed, or salicornia, which you can see in the lower middle part of the slide, together with its cool orange parasitic plant called Dodder.
Called what?
Dodder. D-O-D-D-R. So the next project.
So the plant clearly weaves in old age. Is that the
apparently, Dodder cannot photosynthesize by itself, so that's why it depends on the salicornia. I found all of this fascinating. So in Martin Slough, the project will restore brackish marsh and riparian habitat. This is, again, up in the north coast. It will reintroduce a muted tidal prism and enlarge and enhance off-channel ponds to provide high-flow refugia and rearing habitat for endangered coho salmon, tidewater goby, and other diadromous fish. The project area consists of diked former tidelands currently used as pasture and as a golf course. CDFW staff in the region have been supportive of the project since its inception, and in particular, local staff for over 10 years have been recording some of the highest densities of juvenile coho with the fastest growing rates of any Humboldt Bay tributary located in these ponds on the golf course. And the next project, again, a part of the Elk River watershed is the Elk River Estuary and Tidal Wetlands Enhancement Project, and this goal will restore 112 acres of tidal wetlands and enhance the rearing habitat in the lower estuary of the Elk River. It will expand and enhance critical habitat for coho and other anadromous and salt marsh-dependent species, and it will remove barriers to fish passage. It will also include construction of tidal ridges, which will provide wetland and transition habitat while reducing the potential for flooding impacts to Highway 101, which is immediately west of the project site, with sea level rise. So, in all, the restored marshes and riparian habitat will filter sediments, nutrients, and other contaminants from runoff within the watershed, and it will also help provide improved public access to a trail that goes the entire circumference of Humboldt Bay eventually. The next project at Surfers Point down in Ventura is a planning project that is a continuation of an existing phase one part of the project for manager tree and living shoreline that was constructed in 2010 and 2011 and has become a model for shoreline management and manager tree. With the successful implementation of that segment, we now want to continue with the planning and eventual implementation of the project to provide long-term shoreline protection and incorporate innovative natural coastal ecosystems and a program of managed retreat. So this will involve relocation of public infrastructure out of a hazard zone and restoration of natural coastal rocky cobble beach and coastal dune systems with native drought-tolerant species. Lastly, I would comment that this project is implementing recommendations from the recently adopted California State Sea Level Rise Guidance, where one of the adaptation strategies was manage retreat. And next up is the Restoring Eelgrass and Climate Resilience in San Francisco Bay project, which is in two locations, San Rafael, which is shown, the array for which is shown in the bottom right-hand corner, and the other one is in Richmond, the giant marsh area near Point Pinole, which is shown, the array for which is shown in the upper right-hand corner. And at these sites, eelgrass will be planted near restored native oyster reefs in order to protect the shoreline, provide habitat, improve water quality, sequester carbon, and ameliorate ocean acidification. San Francisco State University, working in partnership with the Coastal Conservancy, has a proven track record of working on similar shorelines projects dating back almost a decade. So this project will build on previous work and will produce a collection of water quality data that will inform the degree to which eelgrass restoration projects may ameliorate ocean acidification and therefore fill in a key data point in the bigger questions that the OPC is asking and funding through Prop 84 and other funding sources to learn more about how ocean acidification amelioration can be promoted and supported through seagrass habitat throughout the state, because we don't currently have a site in San Francisco Bay. And that report is shown in the upper middle of my slide. So I've finished with the project descriptions. I just wanted to show you a brief summary of the proposed funding, and the total comes to $8.4 million. I also wanted to just give you a general sense of the next steps for the Prop 1 program in the future. So if approved today, staff would work to execute the grant agreements and oversee the grants for these projects, but we would also work to implement the next and perhaps last round of Prop 1 funding for the appropriation that will arrive to the OPC with the next fiscal year in July 2019. That appropriation is also $9.3 million. Staff may update the existing grant guidelines for the next round, perhaps with a targeted theme like climate change. And lastly, we would be issuing another request for proposal probably in the spring and proceed from there for the next round of projects. So that concludes my presentation. Thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer your questions, as are the proposed grantees who are also here.
Okay, thank you very much. We have three people that have requested to speak, and we have a fourth, Christy Weir from the City of Ventura, that indicated she's available for questions and also has copies of handout materials. The first of the speakers is Marla Jo Sadowski with Joel
Gerwine.
Okay. It ran together in this, on deck. And Marla Jo, you listed that you're representing the home front in Morro Bay.
That's right.
Okay. Is that a map of the home front?
Home front. It's where it's at. Ooh.
You're going to be using up your 3 minutes.
I know. I don't have a whole lot to say. But this is, yeah, it kind of is a map of my home front. This is a map of... it's the Morro Bay zoning map from 1980, was amended in 1987 and amended in 1997. The reason it's in this big form is because this is the only one of these maps I could find anywhere in town. So, and I didn't, well, anyway, so we have this map, and I don't think you can see it at all. But the point that I'm here to talk to you about today is that I'm just going to read this. First, I'd like to thank you for the recognizing the importance of eelgrass in the Morro Bay Harbor and considering funding this project. That said, I would like to recommend a caveat to the issuance of this grant. Currently, the City of Morro Bay is updating their LCP maps. In the proposed updated maps, the city staff has removed historical ESHA designation. In addition to expunging ESHA designation in the harbor, city staff is redefining some ESHA as aquatic resources and wetland habitat.
And I'm channeling the governor right now by asking you what ESHA means for those that are uninitiated.
Environmentally sensitive habitat area.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Let's see. California Coastal Act Section 30107.5 describes ESHA. The Morro Bay zoning map dated March 19, 1987, amended October 1990, and again in February 97, clearly identifies ESHA zoning boundaries. And the ESHA I'm talking about here, while I'm talking to you, is a lot of this is eelgrass in our area. Prior to the issuance of the Prop 1 funding, please direct the Morro Bay National Estuary Program to collaborate with the Morro Bay Community Development Director to restore the historical ESHA designated in the proposed LCP ESHA maps. Reference the plan of Morro Bay. I don't know how you would do this with your proposal. We do support the project, but we, you know, I noticed. I'll have to send you things afterwards because you're not going to be able to see this. But he's actually taken off a bunch of the ESHA. It's not showing on the new updated LCP. It needs to get put back on there. And since the National Estuary and all these people collaborate, we'd like them to collaborate to help the people of Morro Bay get the ESHA back on the map. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Joel, and then Landon Peppel, you're on deck.
Good afternoon, Terry Laird and members of the council. I'm a project manager at the State Coastal Conservancy, and I'm here to speak in support of all six of the habitat restoration projects that you're considering. The Conservancy has been involved in all of these projects, in providing funding and other support planning stage, implementation stage, variously for different projects. And I've personally been very involved in three of these projects, the ones up around Humboldt Bay. Some of these projects have been a really long time coming, some of them 10 years. You know, if you work in government, you know sometimes these things take a long time to get implemented. And it's really wonderful to see them now at this stage getting to final design and implementation. And the Conservancy is really happy that the OPC is considering lending support for these projects as well. So that's all I wanted to share. I'm happy to answer any questions about these projects and just wanted to thank you so much for considering supporting them.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments. And Landon.
Hello, council members. My name is Landon Peppel, and I'm the Northern California Conservation Director for the Wildlands Conservancy. We own and operate the Eel River Estuary Preserve, one of 15 nature preserves across the state of California. Our mission to preserve the beauty and biodiversity of the earth and to provide programs so that children may know the wonder and joy of nature. So in addition to providing these unique and dynamic conservation projects, we focus on public access, and we host hundreds of thousands of visitors every year, as well as programs for school children, whereas tens of thousands of kids come out to our preserves, hosting everybody, of course, free of charge. Without being redundant to Ms. Cazarola's statements, I apologize for the name, I would like to speak directly to Mr. Rodriguez in regards to collaboration and cooperation. A variety of conservation entities are involved in this project insofar, some of which include state, federal, and local partners, folks at the Wildlife Conservation Board, the State Coastal Conservancy, CDFW through Fisheries Restoration Grant Program, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service through programs such as NACA, NICWIC, and the Pacific Marine and Estuarine Fish Habitat Partnership. So with assurance, there's a great team of folks behind this project, and pending funding approval, we look forward to working with folks at the OPC.
I'll just let those two acronyms go. But it's, you had two acronyms that most people don't have a clue what they stood for.
So with the federal funders, the North American Wetland Conservation Act grant program, as well as the National Coastal Wetland Conservation Grant Program.
Great. Thank you very much. And it's time for questions. And just before we get to general questions, I was going to ask you, the director, Marina, could you remind us in the aggregate what the total amount is in this pot and how it divides between the three different grant processes, that is this one and the next two?
So the Ocean Protection Council has received two out of three of its Prop 1 appropriations. Each of those was $9.3 million. So if I
and
can
the
do the
third
math,
one will be $9.3 million?
Correct.
So we're really at $28 million as a total in the entire pot for the three things. Okay.
Correct.
Just checking. Questions by members of the council? Matt.
There's an earlier reference I think I heard in your presentation about money being set aside for disadvantaged communities or at least smaller projects in disadvantaged communities, and we didn't get any applications. Did I understand that correctly?
No applications for the less than $250,000 category.
Okay.
But definitely a few that said that they were benefiting disadvantaged communities.
And have we awarded any of those projects in disadvantaged communities?
So are you referring to the first round?
Yes.
So I don't have a particular number that I can give you for how many disadvantaged communities were awarded in round one. I know that one of the projects was with the Talua tribe up in the North Coast, and I'm not sure if any of the other.
I think it was about 40% of the fund. We had a requirement to meet 25% of funding mm-hmm. going to disadvantaged communities. I think our first round was 40%, mm-hmm. and I'm recalling this. I will have to verify the numbers. And then in this round, Marina, there we are also achieving a substantial proportion going to disadvantaged communities, right, through Quincy Jones and some of the ones in the North Bay.
Yes.
Since you presented all six, could you just name the ones that are disadvantaged communities for the purposes of that definition?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you already mentioned Quincy Jones. Morro Bay does border one of the disadvantaged communities listed in the EnviroScreen viewer, mm-hmm. As does Eel River. The other project that fits into that category is the San Francisco Bay project. It's located immediately adjacent to Richmond. I think that those are the projects in the list.
Why do you think we didn't get any applications for the smaller, less than 250,000? Have we thought about that?
I have. I think that when we do our outreach and when we are trying to get the word out about the grant opportunity, we can try to do even more to get the word out. We did have five different public outreach workshops in January and February all over the state, trying to make ourselves available to answer questions about the process, clear up any challenges or obstacles or questions about eligibility and that sort of thing, and spend a lot of staff time, you know, on the phone pre-application period to answer any questions. One of the reasons why we didn't get any, at least in the lower quantity category, is just that, you know, it's a significant amount of work to apply for this grant. The process requires a lot of information, and so it may not have been worthwhile for people to apply for just the smaller scale grants. But again, I feel, you know, that we certainly got a good number of projects broadly that qualified as disadvantaged community benefit.
If I can ask a follow-up question, Matt will relate to this. I sit on 25 boards and commissions, and sometimes I cannot remember what discussions we had at which one. And we sit on the Strategic Growth Council, and the Strategic Growth Council had exactly this issue and did a special project on what it would take in sort of directing the outreach and making sure that the participation was actually at a level that you're not waiting for people to come at you. You're figuring out ways to approach them and do it. And then secondarily, in the ag part of the Strategic Growth Council's programs, which are really affiliated with the Resources Agency in the implementation, we were so concerned about people not having the capacity to apply that we allowed for letters of intent that were very brief and stated it. And if we thought that they met it and could do it, then we agreed to go ahead and figured out how they would have the capacity. The point being that between all those things, we looked at ways not just to check the box that we'd done outreach, but actually to try to figure out how to encourage it and be successful in doing it. And I have a feeling we've had this discussion here and we've done it. And maybe it's just that we did it in different programs than the one that you're presenting right now. So I think Deborah has something that she's looked twice like she wants to lean into her mic and say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I think that we have been successful here in reaching disadvantaged communities, and we can certainly do more work and continued outreach, and we can meet with Strategic Growth Council and look at the documents that they've created. But I would say that of eight projects, three of them are directly benefiting disadvantaged communities. That's not a bad ratio. And I think that one of the reasons that the small grant program, which was this pilot program, wasn't successful is because the types of projects that Prop 1 funds are expensive. They are more than $250,000. So when we put a cap of $250,000 on it, we were inherently limiting what you could do. And so maybe that was the problem, like by having a small grants cap that didn't...
That was the point I was obtusely trying to get at, is we sit here and talk in the marine side about adaptive management. In our grant side and adaptive management, would it make sense to not have a cap and think we have enough money for three small ones if we're not getting them, and just try to have one and really go with it? Because that's what we learned from nobody applying for the ones when we had the cap on it. And I think, you know, I appreciate, and I don't want to denigrate the fact that in the larger one, there's been a good percentage and a good response. We just tried the smaller one, and it didn't really get any applicants. And so what did we learn, and how are we going to adjust? But Anne was waiting patiently to get in as well.
Semi-patiently. The State Lands Commission and the Coastal Commission have been going through an exercise to have EJ policies that work. And to say it's a cultural change, at least at State Lands, would be an understatement. However, it has resulted in a series of workshops up and down the South that have been very, very successful with EJ groups participating. The one in Northern California has been held. The one in Southern California has not been held. And I guess I would urge, Deborah, for you to talk to Jennifer about having that be a part of the discussion that occurs as part of that, because it will reach different people than I've seen in some of the other opportunities on this.
Other questions or comments? Matt?
Just to follow up, I think it would be helpful the next round if you talked about, as part of the overall presentation, what sort of outreach was done and could go through that. I think that would be helpful. And then, as Secretary Laird mentioned, I think it would be very helpful to sort of go back, and this is something we've done at the SGC and a number of our programs. Okay, what did we learn from this? Is there something that we could be doing? You know, outreach, is there some way to target the outreach in some way to various communities that didn't participate in this round? Is there a class of, you know, if we've set a $250,000 limit, are there projects out there that we missed? Should we have different application criteria for smaller projects and larger projects? Just, you know, just a postmortem on this sort of thing is helpful. And we've learned from it with some of the other grant programs that we've gone through.
And we are sensitive to the fact that when there's a presentation on different projects, that all these people that are just listening, they're listening to hear us say the percent of disadvantaged communities and how it applies, and it's good to just institutionalize that in the presentations. Further questions or comments? Seeing none, if somebody wanted to make a motion, it would be very similar to the last two, that you make a findings, approve the recommendations, direct the director to implement. That's what Ann just moved. Is there a second?
Second
by Matt. Any further discussion?
Only that I, you know, it's always good when you can go through these grant programs and nobody shows up to say that the program was unfair. So I just want to compliment you on the way you've run this program. And
besides, he made that comment after we closed off public comment.
I've learned. The idea that we're handing out, you know, almost $9 million that the presentations have gone as smoothly as they have, and we've got the quality of projects that we have as, I think, a tribute to the way that you've done the program. So I don't want any of my comments to be construed as criticism. It's just, you know, what can we learn from this and how can we move on? Congratulations on running a very efficient program.
And Matt's speaking for me in those comments as well, because I know what it takes if you're getting $9 million out the door to look at all these and vet them and go through site visits and other things. Further comments? We'll move to a vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much to everybody that worked on that or spoke. We'll move to item number 7, which is an action item, an update on the Global Climate Action Summit. Jen Phillips.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Everyone's clearing the room. I just wanted to
provide a brief update on the Global Climate Action Summit.
There's a few that want to hear what you say. I wouldn't.
Good. I'm just kidding.
You know, money will bring out people for a hearing. So.
Yeah, I know. So I just want to provide an update on the Global Climate Action Summit and OPC's leadership to elevate ocean and coastal achievements, strategies, and actions at this upcoming global stage. So as you may know, this September, Governor Brown will host the Global Climate Action Summit alongside co-chairs Michael Bloomberg, Patricia Espinosa, Anand Mahindra, and Minister Xie of China. This summit serves as a timely opportunity for states, regions, cities, businesses, and many others to showcase climate action, launch new commitments, and encourage leaders across the world to be even more ambitious and bold in our climate targets, starting with COP24 in Poland at the end of this year. The global ocean will be highlighted at this summit to signify the nexus between oceans and climate, increase global attention to the importance of oceans in achieving the Paris Agreement, and focus on priority ocean-related climate mitigation and adaptation measures. So specifically, the summit will spur climate action in five key areas or challenge areas, and the oceans are highlighted in challenge area four. OPC staff, alongside partners and thought leaders, work to incorporate oceans in this summit, recognizing that oceans play a critical role in mitigating climate change, making our world more resilient, and our community is providing scalable climate solutions to elevate on this stage. We have secured two high-level sessions in the main program of the summit, both which will occur on Friday. So just like other challenge areas, our high-level sessions on Friday are a key opportunity to share progress, make pledges, and encourage deeper and renewed commitments. We are working across our global networks to identify key commitments to announce at the summit that will inspire others. For example, we hope to announce several new members of the International Ocean Acidification Alliance, which was founded by the West Coast governments. We seek to also highlight the recent Assembly Joint Resolution, AJR 47, which urges science-driven action to combat the effects of climate change on oceans and disadvantaged communities. And we also hope to elevate key financing and partnership models to advance priority ocean-related climate goals. So one such commitment for the state of California stems from a recently released report by the Nature Conservancy and the State Coastal Conservancy. Together, they completed a first-of-its-kind assessment on the vulnerability of California's coastal habitats to sea level rise. The news is stark. 55% of coastal habitats are highly vulnerable. 39 rare, threatened, or endangered species are vulnerable. And 41,000 acres of coastal conservation lands are going to be affected by 5 feet of sea level rise. However, and this is a figure from the report, this assessment also demonstrates that it's possible to have as much or more coastal habitat with 5 feet of sea level rise as we do today, and it lays out a conservation blueprint to get us there. Achieving this outcome, we know, will require coordinated, sustained effort among government agencies, conservation groups, and leadership at the highest levels. So a common vision for California's coast is really necessary to guide this collective action. In response to this assessment, the resolution before us today puts forth the following coastal vision and a suite of commitments OPC will take to advance this vision. The resolution points to work OPC has led in the ocean climate sphere, recognizing this vision is part of a greater whole. The resolution incorporates feedback from council members and recognizes that the vision advances recommendations put forth in California's Climate Adaptation Strategy, or safeguarding, the updated sea level rise guidance, and the fourth climate assessment, among others. So specifically, in the second part of that resolution is that it acknowledges the vision can be achieved and advanced by various commitments across entities. And specifically, OPC commits to using this vision to guide future policy recommendations related to sea level rise adaptation and coastal habitats, supporting science action to achieve the vision across all levels, taking a leadership role across agencies to ensure natural habitats are considered in all decision-making, using various financing mechanisms to advance the vision, And finally, calling today on other entities across California, so state and local agencies, to adopt this vision and make commitments to advance it, which can be highlighted at platforms such as the Global Climate Action Summit. So with that, I'll close and just say that I think the global community and the California community is coming together from governments to NGOs, industry and scientists, and I'm really proud to see what we can do at the Global Summit and ways in which we can advance this vision. Thank you.
Thank you. And before we go to questions and possible action on the resolution, I have four people that have asked to speak. The first one is Sarah Newkirk, and on deck is Anna Zivian.
Good afternoon, Secretary Laird and members of the Council. I'm Sarah Newkirk, and I'm with the Nature Conservancy. I'm here today to offer my enthusiastic support for the resolution and for the vision of California's coast, future coast. I can't emphasize enough how important this resolution is, but given the length of today's agenda and the lateness of the hour, I will try to keep my enthusiasm under control. Californians
just
have...
Just under 3 minutes.
Californians have voted again and again to protect and invest in our incredible shoreline, and they did it again in June with the passage of Prop 68. Over a third of the coast is protected, conserving incredible habitat and more than 150 rare, threatened, and endangered species. But with 5 feet of sea level rise, our coast of today will not be the same coast in the future. As Jen mentioned, over 55% of our coastal habitat is very vulnerable to sea level rise, including over 141,000 acres of coastal habitat that will be literally drowned with 5 feet of sea level rise. In other words, the very investments that we've made over the years on coastal protection are under severe threat. The Nature Conservancy and the State Coastal Conservancy collaborated on this coastal conservation assessment, not only to assess the carnage, but to see what we can do about it. And that's why we created this wall-to-wall conservation blueprint for the entire coast, identifying solutions down to a resolution of individual 1 kilometer hexagons of habitat. But the big news is that there is hope. With sustained coordinated effort, our study shows that we can have as much or more coastal habitat with 5 feet of sea level rise as we do today. It won't be easy, and it won't just require habitat protection. We'll have to protect future potential habitat to mitigate for the lost land that will be drowned with sea level rise. We'll have to add sediment to marshes to allow them to keep their heads above water with sea level rise. And most importantly, we'll have to get our heads around the queasiness that we have associated with managed retreat and invest in projects like the Surfers Point Project in Ventura all across California. If we're going to accomplish this, we need not only OPC, but all California's coastal decision makers to get on board with this vision and make commitments of their own. We'll need the Coastal Conservancy, the Coastal Commission, the State Lands Commission, Wildlife Conservation Board, the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and others to align their decisions and financial support toward achieving this goal. Through this resolution, you're taking a critical first step toward this vision of coastal hope. We thank you for this incredible commitment, and also thank your magnificent staff for putting it forward for your consideration. However, we ask you to do more than just adopt the resolution, although we do ask you to do that. We also need you to call on your sister agencies and local governments to sign up on the vision and make commitments of their own. With this alignment, we can reassert California's leadership in coastal protection, and we can really create a new hope for our coast. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think the magnificent staff noted your comments. We'll go to Anna Zivian, and Natalie Kalk is on deck.
Good afternoon again, Anna Zivian, Ocean Conservancy. And I wanted to echo Sarah's enthusiasm and support for the resolution and all the hard work of the OPC staff in working on the Global Climate Action Summit. We have been working with them, and they've been incredibly open and receptive to the comments. And I think this is a great opportunity for us because we know how important the ocean is to climate and how susceptible it is to climate change. And this is a chance to bring this message to a wider audience, to promote the importance, the idea of the importance of the ocean, and to take advantage of a global summit this September. The resolution will help us do that, and I echo Sarah's call to encourage other agencies and government entities to promote this vision and the agenda, the action items to move this forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Natalie, you're up, and Joel, you're on deck.
Thank you, Chair Laird and Council members. I'm Natalie Kalk, Program Manager for California Coastkeeper Alliance. The Global Climate Action Summit presents an important opportunity to bring oceans to the forefront of the climate conversation and to inspire forward-looking, nature-based solutions to mitigate the effects of climate change on our ocean and coastline. CCKA is working with OPC staff and other ocean leaders to develop programming for the summit and would like to thank OPC for their leadership in planning two ocean-focused sessions and ensuring that ocean and coastal issues are highlighted in the main agenda of the summit. We also applaud OPC and all others involved for bringing forward the proposed California Coastal Vision Commitment. The commitment will demonstrate California's position as a global leader on ocean protection in the face of climate change. In particular, we're happy to see that this common vision is being considered across multiple state agencies, which will further guide collective action at local, state, federal, and international levels. On another front, CCK has been thrilled to partner with OPC and others on a joint resolution, AJR 47, which Jen mentioned in her presentation, affirming the California legislature's support for science-driven, nature-based solutions to combat the effects of climate change on ocean and coastal communities. This resolution, along with OPC's Coastal Vision Commitment, builds on years of work to prepare the state for changing ocean conditions. We again thank OPC for their strong commitment to and leadership on this issue and look forward to a fantastic summit in September. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Joel?
Joel Gerwin, Project Manager at the Coastal Conservancy. I'm also here to speak in support of this resolution. And to say that the Coastal Conservancy is looking forward to working with the OPC on this daunting but very important effort, and it'll really be critical to have your magnificent staff to work with to make this happen. I'll just share a quick factoid about salt marsh dodder, which is that parasitic plant that we heard earlier about as a metaphor for what we need to do here. There was a study that looked at the impact of removing salt marsh dodder in some experimental plots versus the controlled plots where it was left in place. And in those plots where this parasitic plant, which you wouldn't think would necessarily be really helping the other marsh plants, was removed, those plots lost diversity, and a few plant species came to dominate there, because they weren't being suppressed at all by this parasitic plant. So I mention this just to suggest that we need to get all of our agencies and partners together. We might not always think that we have a role to play, but we really, if we're going to have a healthy coastal habitat and ecosystem, we've got to bring us all forward together and work on this, and I look forward to doing that with you.
Thank you, and thank you for introducing new facts to the discussion. We'll bring the matter back before the council for any deliberation and action. Anne?
I want to thank the staff for responding to the controller's concern that we capture in this not just the very important natural habitat, but things like ports and sewer systems and things that, you know, it's going to be kind of difficult to move as sea level rise comes. And we worry that if the agencies who are not on the front end of the environmental piece of this don't start now saying it's both and how do we do this, some really bad group of people will be deciding how we ought to do this, and they'll separate the two. And we think that would be an unfortunate way for us to be proceeding with this. And so we are grateful for that. Nobody's come and asked us to take this to state lands at our meeting in August, but I guess from people who've testified, that would be something of interest to some of the people. And so we'll see about putting it on our agenda at our August meeting. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any further discussion? Any, Mark?
Thank you, Anne, for writing about that comment. And I want to add a little bit to that. There is a lot of important, significant public infrastructure that provides all these non-habitat, non-ecosystem benefits. But there's also a whole lot of development that is up and down the California coast as elsewhere, and since we're asking folks to share and buy into this vision, I'm going to suggest that staff should look at having a little more explanation of what we mean by social, economic, and recreational benefits. Not that far up the coast from Surfers Point, which I spent a number of years surfing at, and actually started surfing there in the 19th,
a while ago,
where the beach was much, much wider. That was, you know, Paleolithic era. But only a mile or so up, the entire coastline for the next roughly 10-15 miles is armored. And it's armored to protect homes. In fact, at Surfers Point, a little bit away from the very point itself, it's armored to protect a hotel. Some of that, you know, there's going to be significant impacts on non-public infrastructure from sea level rise. And those folks are going to scream, hey, we should be protected too if you're protecting that. I really think we need a little bit more explanation of what we intend to address by adding social, economic, and recreational benefits in this vision statement. Okay? Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Great, really great job on this. And I'm looking forward to see what happens at the summit.
And appreciate your feedback as always. So thanks.
Thank you. Any other comments? Somebody desirous of moving the resolution?
So moved.
Motion by Michael, second by Ann. Last call. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Do we have public comment? We have two public comments under the public comment period, and they're from both halves of the Sadowski family. Marla, Joe, and then Richard, and you could choose to go in whatever order you want. And it would be an added benefit if you disagree with each other.
Richard Sadowski, citizen of Morro Bay. I come to these meetings because you guys are a ray of hope in California, and once again, your staff and the council is in the times that we live in right now with the government and the federal government going on and what's going on even in our local government, I feel that it's a ray of trust and a ray of hope with what's going on here and what we hear and what we learn here every time. One of the things that I would like to kind of mention, and some of you've mentioned, was the managed retreat and safeguarding the critical infrastructure and the balancing of climate change adaptation and safeguarding and keeping that in mind with the environmental justice policies that are being developed in different communities, especially the disadvantaged communities. And one of the things that I really appreciate that the OPC has done in the last several years is integrating the social sciences and the humanity aspect of what it means to adapt to climate change and what it means, how it's going to affect our older people and our future generations. So once again, thank you so much for all you guys do. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your comments. Marla Joe, you get the last word.
Hi. I guess I should come back, and I'm Marla Joe Sadowski. I am representing Homefront Morro Bay, and we are, like you sitting up there, we're new to environmental justice policy, and we're a group of activists, environmentalists who want to tackle what environmental justice looks like and what we think, what the public thinks environmental justice will be. So we're going to be helping you. And we've already met our environmental justice representative from the Coastal Commission, and that was a lovely meeting. We may be up to state lands, you know. What I think we can all agree is we don't really know what that looks like, and so nobody has all the answers. The things that we have a case study in our hometown that's going on right now with managed retreat and a disadvantaged community and opportunists, maybe we can say, who don't really understand the whole climate change venue and the greenhouse gas reduction and all of these things that need to be taken into projects and looking at them to say if they're green or not green or if it's the right time to do it or they're not the right time. Anyway, we have a pilot environmental justice project in Morro Bay. And so I'll see you around.
Well, thank you very much for your comments. Thanks, everybody, for a great meeting. And the details of the next meeting are at the end of the agenda, and we will stand adjourned.